Okay, I guess my turn. I'm Ricardo Deca. I'm from the Department of Physics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. By the way, that one once appeared in Jeopardy as being the longest name for a university in the United States. And I'm the, I guess, the experimentalist of the week. I will be here until Friday. And what I will be talking about today is our measurements that we have done about on the Casimir force, and we use the technique that we use is microelectromechanical torsional oscillators. For those of you that have been here for an extended period of time, these oscillators are very similar to the ones that Capasso had used, and Hobun Chan also has presented a talk on them. I will sort of halfway through on my talk, I will just point them to one small difference, but otherwise they are very similar. So before I continue, I would like to acknowledge all my collaborators and the funding. Funding is coming from National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, and Los Alamos National Lab. And the collaborators are Daniel Lopez from, currently he's at Argonne National Lab, but when this work was done, he was at Lucent. There are not very many people still at Lucent, but he was there at the time. Ephraim Fischbach from Purdue University, Dennis Krauss from Wabash College and Purdue University, Vladimir Mostepanenko and Galina Klinchevskaya, both from Russia. Eduardo Skigil, we worked together on a 3 months period that he was as a Fulbright Fellow at our lab, and we work on the low temperature measurements that, if I have time, I will show today. And Jing Ding is a student working with me at IUPUI. So basically what we're going to be looking at is if we have vacuum fluctuations in the presence of boundaries, then we have what is called the Casimir force. And if the plate that we have, if these are two infinite plates and they present an infinite conductivity, then we have to take into account the vacuum fluctuations in order to look into the density, energy density in the cavity between the two plates. And due to the fact that they are perfect metals, or due to the fact that there are boundaries, then the modes are going to be restricted. So then if we do a counting of the modes with the energy they have, taking into account that the modes are restricted in the inside but not restricted on the outside, we get that for this ideal situation where the separation is A, the pressure between the force per unit area between these two infinite plates varies as 1 over the separation to the fourth power. Instead of using that approach, which requires vacuum fluctuations on the boundaries, we follow the approach that Lipschitz used and take into account fluctuation dissipation in the dipoles, basically constituting this material. And then we say, well, but this material is a perfect conductor. We also get to the same result. We'll see that when we do the comparisons between our experiments and the theory, the method used in order to get the theoretical calculations is this Lipschitz approach. This Casimir force is the dominant force at separations, at small separations. If the separation is very small, the force is non-retarded, and if it is large, it is retarded, and that makes the difference between the van der Waals and the Casimir force. So as we continue to shrink in nanotechnology, the features between, and not only the feature, but also the separation between features in order to do machines with mobile parts, but very, very small, so nanoelectromechanical systems and microelectromechanical systems, this force that is going to be there associated with vacuum fluctuation is in general attractive, and is going to basically, is the main responsible to causing extinction between the different parts, and then it basically, that yields a failure of the system. So people are working kind of hard in order to try to find out how to counter-arrest this interaction between, this attractive interaction in the Casimir force, or in general attractive interaction in the Casimir force. And one possibility of controlling this interaction is by engineering the materials, and there have been several different proposals in which the materials could be metamaterials in which have a large magnetic response, or plasmonic wires in which they have a plasmonic contribution in which might make it repulsive, but when the medium between the two plates is vacuum or very, very, very low pressure, there has been no experimental demonstration that the Casimir force is in or could be found to be repulsive. All measurements of the Casimir force with vacuum between the inside the cavity has all been attractive. So far there are models, but there are no experimental confirmations.
Is this for all geometries or just this parallel plate geometry?
Most experimental, what my statement was about that there has been no experimental confirmation of a repulsive force. The two basically geometries that have been used to measure the Casimir force are a plate but has some difficulties, and a plate sphere, which is simpler because the sphere is always aligned with the plate. And the materials that have been used so far are basically metals. And so there are just starting now very, very few efforts trying to start with metamaterials, in which basically there are different approaches in which the magnetic response is enhanced either by doing small split ring resonators or just by positioning basically little silver rods in an array, just trying to enhance the magnetic response. There has been the proposal that will be given a repulsive interaction. There are not definitive measurements yet, although there are already some theoretical papers saying that it will not give a repulsive interaction. But anyways, going back to your question, is all measurements have been done on the plate sphere configuration.
So are you referring specifically to vacuum when you talk about repulsion?
No, there have been measurements.
No, but I mean, when you said you're looking, are you talking about repulsion and vacuum?
Correct, because that is the condition in which a nanoelectromechanical and microelectromechanical system work. It's not with a liquid in between, in which a repulsive has been observed. Oops, well, anyways. I didn't start talking about this one. I will show that there are some discrepancies in the interpretation, particularly in the thermal dependence of the Casimir Casimir effect, and this happens when instead of considering idealized material with infinite conductivity, we consider that the materials have real conductivity and are at a finite temperature. What is the model that should be used in order to understand those? And I will show that using a Drude model or a plasma model do give results that are, one is in agreement, the plasma model, the Drude model is not in agreement with the measure, with the measurements we have done. And finally, and actually this is the reason why we started working with, in collaboration with Ephraim Fishback in this field, the Casimir force is a background that is going to be there when we try to see if there are any other forces, any hypothetical forces or correction to Newtonian gravity when the separation between the bodies is small. So it came to a shock to me when I learned this, but basically we know that Newtonian gravitational potential works very well for separations, well, right now up to about 10 microns, but when you go to separations on the order of 10 nanometers, there could be a force which is 10 to the 25 stronger than gravity, and still we don't experimentally have a clue if it is there or not. And when you try to measure if it is there or not, the background is the Casimir interaction. So the Casimir interaction also has consequences in this way. So the outline of my talk, I will divide my talk in three parts. And I want to cover the first part, which are basically the title of the talk, the precise measurements of the Casimir force. I will show this, the experimental setup, what is the minimum detectable force that we can achieve with our setup. How do we measure the position separation and all the calibrations included in the measurement of the position separation and the force? Show an error budget, which is probably different from error budgets that you have usually seen, and then a comparison with theory. Time permitting, I will show two very short other experiments. One is a low temperature extension. I hope it will be clear at some point why we're trying to do low temperature measurements of the Casimir force. It's already a complicated experiment, and we're trying to complicate it even more just going to low temperatures. But I hopefully I will give an idea of why it will be clear why we don't want to do this experiment. And also one approximation that we use throughout our measurements is the proximity force approximation. And if time permitting, I also will show an experimentalist view of proximity force approximation and experimentally what we have tried to do in order to address the validity of the proximity force approximation. Our experiment consists in having a microelectromechanical torsion oscillator, a schematic, our cartoonist schematic of the experiment is here on the top right. We have a torsional oscillator which consists of this blue plate over which we deposit our material. Everything I will be talking today is gold. This torsional oscillator can oscillate along this axis. The oscillator, instead of having a torsional rod, it has a torsional serpentine. And on top of this oscillator, there is a sphere. It's a sapphire sphere covered with gold. And the separation between the sphere and the plate is a Z. And attached this optical, sphere is attached to an optical fiber. And the measurement between the end of the optical fiber and the substrate is going to be continuously monitored by a two-color optical interferometer. The dimensions of the plate, this is actually scanning electron microscope micrograph of the actual plate, the blue one here, is half a millimeter by half a millimeter, and there is a gap here at the corner, so you can actually see that this plate is floating with a gap of about 2 microns. So this can actually move laterally, and sort of a cartoon of how this happens. Basically, as the sphere comes, gets closer to the oscillator, the oscillator is going to bend, and that angle, that deflection, is the angle that we're going to measure. Then, if we know the spring constant of the torsional oscillator, and we measure the deflection, then we will be able to obtain the force. So basically what we want to do is obtain the force of the interaction between the sphere and the plate, and at the same time, the separation between the sphere and the plate, so we can do a measurement of force as a function of separation.
Sorry,
any question?
Why the serpentine?
Why the serpentine instead of the rod? It's the next biograph. So basically what one wants to achieve is at the end, if everything else can be filtered, if there are no other constraints, the thermodynamic limit on how small a force we can determine is going to be given by this expression. Bear in mind that we are actually measuring torques. So there is a B here, which is a lever arm, but the minimum detectable force is going to be proportional to the square root of kbt. Kappa is the spring constant. And then we're going to have the resonant frequency of the oscillator multiplied by the quality factor of the oscillator. So everything else, if we could keep everything else the same, in order to have the minimum possible detectable force to be as small as possible, what we want to do is make kappa, the spring constant, as small as possible. If you go through the calculations, if you have a rod or if you have a serpentine with the geometry that we have, the cap of the serpentine is basically the cap of the rod divided by about 40. And that is done, in general, what is going to happen when you do that, also you're going to be affecting the resonant frequency and the Q. So since we are reducing kappa, we are affecting the resonant frequency, but we are not affecting Q, the quality of the oscillator, too much. The quality of our oscillators is on the order of 10,000. So that is the reason why we go to the serpentine, and here is roughly what I was saying before. This is basically the main difference between the oscillators that Ho-Boon Chan is using and the oscillators that we use. So he's using a torsional rod, we use a serpentine. The torsional rod, as I said, the resonant frequency is higher. So basically that pushes you away from all the low frequency noises that are always present. But our resonant frequency still is large enough that we are away from that. From the low frequency noise.
Just remind me, I'm sorry, getting the zero of separation, setting that zero. How do you do this?
It will come later on, and it is one important point. So we do it throughout. Just to give you, we do it through a known force, which is an electrostatic force. But I will come to that later on. So the first thing we need to do is understand our system. And I said before that the minimum detectable force, if everything else were not present, would be given by this expression. In reality, there are a bunch of other things which are present. In particular, we have, for example, the signal that we have. What we do is we have this plate, and we measure the capacitance between the plate, half of the plate, and one electrode that is underneath, and half of the plate and the other electrode that is underneath. So basically, the capacitance is between this electrode and the plate, and that electrode and the plate. So we have two capacitances. If this is flat, the difference in that capacitance is expected to be zero. As that deflects, we get a deviation signal, and that is the signal that we measure. Here is basically a cartoon of our oscillator. So we have the capacitor on the right, the capacitor on the left. We are circulating the same, applying the same voltage. So the currents that circulate through these two capacitors are amplified by an amplifier. And one of the parts that is going to happen is that this amplifier will have some noise, and it has to be included in there. So when we start analyzing the thermodynamical noise and all the electronic noise and vibrational noise and so on and so forth, the best solution that you can have for an oscillator is do the measurement in resonance. Because when you do the measurement in resonance, basically if you plot 1 over this function here, what you do get is that you're going to get basically almost the thermodynamical contribution if you're working at resonance. If you work away from resonance, then basically your measurement is going to be limited by all the other factors. This is here in the top left, is just to show that the oscillator works very close, or as close as we can determine, with as a simple harmonic oscillator. So the red dot is the measurement. The white line is I was going to say a field, but it's actually not a field. We determine everything independently, and we just basically put the white line on top of the red line. There are no free feeding parameters here. So basically, this is just what we would expect from our system if the system were to be a simple harmonic oscillator, and what we actually measure. And you can see that there is a very good agreement.
But under this, the resonance frequency of your oscillator.
Say that again.
700.
Yes, right. The resonance frequency of the oscillator is about 704 hertz, and this is done when the sphere is far away from the oscillator. So if we don't want to do the measurements at resonance, then the approach that we use is slightly different. And what we do is we bring a sphere close to the plate, then we deter the tape, the plate, and we measure the interaction now between the plate and the sphere when the plate is detering. In order to deter the plate, what we do is we just apply a sinusoidal signal to one of the electrodes in order to, with electrostatic force, cause the plate to move. So if we do that, then what we have is a simple harmonic oscillator, but now, since the sphere is close to the plate, there is an extra contribution that is coming from the Casimir force. Now, this Casimir force is not harmonic, so there is this extra contribution, which basically what it does the resonant frequency of the oscillator to decrease, so it softens the oscillator, but then there are nonlinear terms, and we have to be careful with those nonlinear terms when we want to do a precision measurement. So we have to make sure that our potential, now it was harmonic, now it is harmonic with the Casimir force, so it opens up a little bit, but also it tilts towards one side. So we have to make sure that all the measurements that we are doing, basically there is no difference between the harmonic contribution and that the unharmonic contribution is very, very small. So basically then what we're going to be doing is measuring the change in the resonant frequency. And by the change in the resonant frequency, knowing the resonant frequency when the sphere is far away from the plate, then we can get the gradient of the Casimir force if we know the parameters of our oscillator. When we do that, and basically I'm just going to, using the proximity force approximation from this gradient of the Casimir force, we can get the Casimir pressure or the equivalent Casimir pressure between two plates which are separated at the same distance. But instead of just measuring the Casimir force between the sphere and the plate, we are measuring or determining the Casimir pressure between two plates separated at the same distance. So if we do that, we basically obtain this equivalent Casimir pressure as a function of separation. And this, for example, we have the blue dots and the red dots, both measured as a function of separation. And since these measurements were done with spheres of 300 microns, red, or 150 microns, blue, and by just obtaining this equivalent Casimir pressure, of course, it's not going to be dependent on the diameter of the sphere, and then you can see that we have exactly the same curve. In order to give you an idea of what is the noise that we have in our measurements, basically we're trying to make this, just show the error, so we're subtracting a background here, and we're subtracting what we believe is a Casimir pressure, but you can see that the error in the Casimir pressure is on the order of 2 millipascals at 150 nanometers, and it is on the order of 1 millipascal at about 300 nanometers. So the error, the relative error at 300 nanometers, which is about here, is one part in 200.
I don't get the what's the black hole? Is arrow bars?
These are basically the dots. The measured dots are all at the center. I'm plotting here the error bars, which are basically not impossible to see on this graph. I'm just highlighting what the error bars are in this measurement. So what I was saying is that at 150 nanometers, the error bars are basically 2 millipascals.
Okay. You are subtracting the theoretical prediction, yeah?
I'm subtracting one theoretical prediction, but for now, just forget about that. I just want to show what the errors are in this part. And the next...
You have a clear idea of the picture. Yeah?
Right. So basically, this is... I'm subtracting from the experimental data a theoretical prediction in order just to be able to show what the error bars are.
Okay. Is there some reason why your experimental data doesn't continue down to the limit that's shown in the right-hand graph?
I just cut it here. It's just, no, I mean, all my data goes to 162 nanometers. There is a trade-off there, basically. If I go... In some of my data, I have been able to go a little bit below, but what happens at some point is that the system jumps to contact. And when it jumps to contact, my experiment is done. I mean, it's not happily done. So basically, what I usually try to avoid that jump into contact, and that's why I typically measure to about 150, 160 nanometers.
That's the lower limit I'm getting. But the range is 150?
It's about 150 to 700. 750 is plotting here, basically, is within my noise. So my measurements, most of the measurements I'm going to show are from 150 to 750 nanometers. Yes?
Do you have an explanation for why the error is non-monotonic, for instance?
Yes. The error here, basically, we have this error in here, and what is going on is that as we move closer and closer, the Casimir force is bigger, so the gradient is larger, but also the errors that we have in the Casimir force are larger. So that is why the errors are not all the same throughout the distance, throughout the separation.
For large separations, should be more difficult to measure, but to get out the Casimir force, right? I mean, why is the error not increasing then? Because the Casimir force is small.
This is an error in a frequency, right? How I'm able to measure the frequency, it depends on two things. One, how well can I measure the frequency, and the other one is in how much am I riding on the force curve. As you said, since the force becomes smaller, the error becomes smaller. I think what we wanted to say is the relative error of this error divided by the actual measurement of the pressure that increases as the separation increases. Okay? But the error depends on two terms. One is how well can I measure the frequency, which is the same throughout my system. And it is 6 millihertz is my error in the frequency. And then how big this term is with the error on that term. Okay?
So this is gold on the meter.
This is a sphere is covered with gold and the plate is covered with gold. Yes, it's a gold-gold interaction. Okay, I show you a graph in which basically was measuring the pressure as a function of separation. Now what I'm going to try to convince you is that is a precise measurement. In order for that to be a precise measurement, I have to tell you how I'm measuring the separation, which I'm going to come to your question. And I also have to tell you, well, I basically told you how I was measuring the pressure. So in measuring the separation, there are basically the separation I want to measure is this one. The distance between the plate and the sphere. There is one separation that I'm going to be talking on detail, which is the separation between the optical fiber and the plate. That separation is measured at all times. So continuously I'm actually measuring the separation between the end of the fiber and the plate. There is another distance that is measured continuously, which is how much the plate has been has tilted. So B, the lever arm times the angle, is measured continuously. And what is measured continuously? Well, B is determined at the beginning of the experiment, and theta is measured at every position just by measuring the differences in capacitance between the plate and the two electrodes. So in order to determine then Z, I also need to determine the gap between or the distance between the top of the plate and the reference plate before I start my experiment. That is done also with using white light interferometry. And then basically I need to determine what this distance is. This is basically a two-step, but for everything that I'm going to say, you can forget about the two-step. But what I do is first, optically, I basically get an idea of what this Z0 is. And then what I do is, instead of using the Casimir force, I use the electrostatic force between a sphere and an infinite plane in order to get an idea of in order to determine what that Z0 is. Here on the top right is basically a list of how accurate are we determining all these measurements, and the experimental technique used in determining the different quantities. So there are some of them which are basically have the wiggly line. It doesn't mean that it is not determined precisely. It means that it is of that order and it changes from experiment to experiment. Yes.
What do you know about the roughness of these surfaces?
I'm going to come back, but the roughness is we have basically grains, although take the grain with a grain of salt. We have mounds which are about 200 nanometers, and the peak-to-peak height on the plate is on the order of 20 nanometers. The peak-to-peak height difference on the sphere is on the order of 9 nanometers. But I'm going to show you. I don't know if it is the next. No, I still have a few biographs to go on until I get there.
But. Yeah, but given that, I mean, what does 0.1 nanometer mean?
Right. I'm going to come back. Basically, what happens in that case? Well, I will try to answer it now. But you have a rough surface, two rough surfaces, one in front of the other, and then you have an interaction. And so the interaction is basically to some position of that surface, which is going to be within your fluctuation, and another position of that surface, which is going to be between those fluctuations. These positions are going to be independent of the separation between the two bodies. And that is actually one of our flaws, which I'm going to touch when I talk about the electrostatic calibration. I'm going to show that when we do the electrostatic calibration, we basically measure this separation, under the influence of the electrostatic calibration. And then what I'm going to assume is that average position is the same for the Casimir interaction. And that is, I'm assuming that.
Okay. Do you see a drift in this Z0 with distance? Or?
Of Z0, no. I mean, this the sphere is glue of Z metal.
No, Z0, I mean...
No, Z0 is the... no. The sphere is glued to the fiber.
Okay. Okay, maybe... But in Z metal, the shortest...
I think you're worried about the angle and the thing moving over a little bit, right?
It's laterally? So if I see a lateral motion?
So the actual minimum distance.
No, at some stage you have to calibrate, right? I mean.
Correct. And
that you get your that shortest distance separation or so. And another experiment.
That is an AFM language that I don't use because I actually never touch. But but yes, I do get. For one particular, what I'm going to do is use my electrostatic calibration to, knowing what Zi is at one particular point, determine what Z metal is. And from that point on, the only thing I'm measuring is this one, and theta.
Yeah. Yes. I'm trying to remember my junior high school geometry, and I haven't had a copy yet. So, but if I move theta by a certain angle, that means the minimum, the place of the minimum,
correct,
is going to be shifted.
Right. There is a correction.
Zero. That arrow should be tilted a little bit.
Correct.
Yeah.
That correction is on the order. I mean, theta is on the order of 10^-5 at the highest separation. So although you're right, that correction in the effective lever arm is very small. I wish that that were the experimental. A problem, but right.
And the fact that the radius is big, small, this is secondary to multiplying by that.
Right. I mean, as you were saying, if I have a plate and a sphere here, the distance from here will be b. Now, when I tip this one, this is going to be a different b. But if this angle is very, very small, the correction is going to be very, very small.
As I said, if I had enough coffee by now, it would be obvious from the start. And I guess by that same measure, it's obvious that even if the force is exerted at some kind of an angle, it's still acting effectively.
Exactly right. It's the same. I mean, the torque is almost perpendicular just by doing the same argument. The force is almost perpendicular to the lever arm by the same argument. Okay, how do we do the separation measurement? We use an electrostatic force calibration. There actually has been a very interesting point brought up by Lamoureux about the electrostatic force calibration. We believe that this electrostatic force calibration is correct. So we believe that the force between a plane and a sphere, a metal plane and a metal sphere, follows this expression, in which basically, instead of using this long expression, it can be approximated to a very large degree of precision with a relative error on the order of 10^-5 if we just do an expansion in R over, Z over R, and we just consider 7 terms. So if we consider 7 terms in this expansion, so replacing this summation by this summation under here, instead of taking infinite terms, we never take infinite terms, but this is a very slowly converging series, we just take 7 terms expanded like this, we have a very good agreement between the two summation terms. However, as I said before, there are no experimental precision measurements saying that this expression is correct. So if somebody does a...
There's a paper in PRA recently about this electrostatic calibration saying that there is a disagreement between...
The paper by Roberto is about a different statement, which I'm also going to come back. It's not exactly about the force itself. There are some remarks by Kim and Lamoureux saying that there are no experimental measurements of this force. So everything that you are listening from this talk from now on, if tomorrow somebody comes and says that this force is incorrect, everything I'm going to say from now on is also incorrect, because it is critical for my determination that this expression holds. I'm going to come back to V0 in one biograph. But basically what we do then is we do measure what is the deviation of our plate under this electrostatic force. How do we do that? We apply different potentials between the plate and the sphere. So this term is different from zero. And then we see what is the dependence as a function of the separation.
Could I just
sure.
feel like I'm missing the point here. Are you alluding to possible corrections to electrostatics or to the material? I mean, presumably that formula is a textbook formula for the force between a perfectly conducting sphere and a perfectly conducting plate. Is that right?
It's between a sphere and a plate. It is a textbook expression that the best direct measurements of the Coulomb force that we have are not very precise as a force.
But a failure of Coulomb's law would be more interesting than anything else you're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the people who are criticizing this, are they criticizing Coulomb's law? Or are they
no. Basically, what is the effect that the plate is not infinite? What are the effects that the plates are not infinite? What are the effects,
No, we actually heard one speaker say Coulomb's law had not been adequately.
As a force, that is a correct statement. But there are independent determinations of the Coulomb interaction.
I mean, that has been said. Are we really sure it's first power and potential and stuff?
I mean, Coulomb's law is tested in electron.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to argue with you.
Distance scales that are far lower than this. So.
Go argue with that guy. Give me his email.
But so you're talking about like finite size corrections.
Corrections that we have to incorporate in here. The statement by Kim and Lamoureux is what he just repeated is that Coulomb force as a force has not been precisely measured because there are better ways of testing it. But then on top of this, if somebody says that this has errors, everything else I'm going to say is also has errors. The way how do we do the measurements, I said, is we expand in these seven terms. We apply different potentials between the plate and the sphere, and then we just measure at these different potentials what is the force. And now, if you can see, there is a Z bar here, which is basically, well, at all times, I actually didn't know what my horizontal scale was, and I'm using that as a fitting parameter to make this electrostatic force coincide. The expression for electrostatic force coincide with my data. We do that by doing, I'm showing two here, but of course we do a variety of these experiments. And there is also another parameter that's in here, which is V of the sphere. So what is the potential that we have to apply to the sphere in order to make this zero? So in general, what happens is you will say, well, this is gold, that one is gold. So when the potential difference between them is zero, the electrostatic force should be zero. In reality, it is not the case. There are some arguments saying that this is just because it is a difference in the work functions. These are granular materials. And so the orientation of one grain with the orientation of some other grain might be different. Truth be told, that doesn't completely explain this V0 that needs to be applied, and it is not very clear where that, at least not to me, where that V0 is coming from. So, experimentally, there is a V0 that needs to be applied in order to make the electrostatic force equals to zero, so whatever else that we measure when we measure want to measure the Casimir force, that V0 or that electrostatic force has been subtracted. Yes?
In other experiments, it was pointed out that this V0 or VR gold is Z-dependent.
I cannot talk for other people. I can talk for my experiments. I can tell you two things about my experiments. I have good experiments in which V0 is constant as a function of Z, and V0 must be constant as a function of C if I want to use that expression. Must be constant as a function of Z, as a function of time, and as a function of position. When I go and do my scanning on top of my sample, my V0 is constant. And there has been some misunderstanding here that we do not say what V0 is. In my paper, when I say V0 is constant, I mean constant. Within my noise is constant. Okay? So that is not the case always. We have samples in which we contaminate. In samples that we contaminate, this is not constant. It has variations on the order of 100 millielectron volts. We do not deal with those samples. I cannot do a precision measurement on a sample that, for whatever reason, is contaminated.
And what about, because in the same paper where Vinod was criticized, there was also a comment about the exponent in the force. What about in your experiment?
Once again, there is not a single exponent in my force.
But the
leading term is 1 over
Vinod, the square. Some people say, if I remember well, the point was that it was not 2, it was 1.0.
No. The argument, if you're talking about Roberto's paper, the argument, remember that what he measures is also the derivative of the force with respect to the separation.
Sure.
So the first term in here, the first term in this expression, as it is written down in here, is 1 over z. Okay? If you take the derivative, the first term is 1 over z squared. And what he was saying is that in his experiment, his sphere, the radius of his sphere is 30 centimeters, so it's huge. And the separation goes, in his experiment, go from 30 nanometers, if I remember correctly, all the way up to a few microns. But at any rate, R over Z is huge in his experiment. He basically is dealing with a plane-plane interaction. So in his situation, the leading term should be the most dominant term. And he does not find that the leading term, or if he tries to fit this expression with a single exponent, he does not find that 2, which in the expression I have, I should say 1, is the right exponent. If I try to do with my system, this exponent here is not 1 either.
So
it's a combination of 8 of them.
The dimension of the sphere, which saves everything.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, because of the dimension of your sphere, you are not a big sphere, you have no problem with the exponent.
I don't have an exponent. What the difference is, in his experiment, he should have basically a single exponent because his sphere is so big.
Yeah.
But he doesn't find it. Also, in his experiment, he doesn't have a V naught that is constant either, as he points out in his paper.
Just one more question. So this calibration is done in a regime where the electrostatic forces are enormously dominant.
It is in a regime. Well, there are two parts to this calibration. V naught.
That's keeping me is you're calibrating and forgetting everything
yes.
else but electrostatics.
The electrostatic force is done between the for the calibration per se is done between 3 microns and 5 microns, in which the Casimir force is negligibly small. The V naught, on the other hand, is check that it is constant throughout the range between my 150 nanometers all the way up to 5 microns. So in this part of this range, below 1 micron is where I will do the Casimir force measurements. But it is checked that it is constant throughout the range. Okay. How do we measure the separation between the end of the fiber and the plate? So basically, so far what we have done is at some separation, we know what this Z is just by using the electrostatic calibration. Now I need to transfer that into knowing it at all times instead of just having to repeat the calibration at all separations, which I can't, right? I cannot do the electrostatic separation where the Casimir force is important. So I have to do the electrostatic calibration at a large separation and then use something else in order to know what the separation is as I go into the Casimir regime, into the sub-micron regime. So for that, we use an interferometric measurement. So basically, what I want to measure is this Zi at all separations. So how do we do that? We use basically a modified microphone interferometer. It's a fiber interferometer. So we send light through one branch. It reflects one mirror, and it reflects off the end of the fiber, and it reflects off the end of the substrate, right? So we have a reflection here and a reflection there. In order to do the light that we send here has two components. One has a long coherence, 1.55 micron communication stabilized laser, and the other one is a laser diode, low coherence, with a coherence length of about 20 microns at 1240 nanometers. So what is the deal with this? If you look into this low coherence, this mirror can be put as at a position in which this optical path is the same as the optical path between that point and the substrate, and then I'm going to have constructive interference for the low coherence, or I can move it a little bit closer and it will be the same length at which I will have that this length is the same as that length, the reflection up to the end of the fiber. And I will have constructive interference with the low coherence. And I will not have constructive interference with the low coherence anywhere else. For the large coherence, for the long coherence, so for the continuous wave, of course I will have periodic constructive interference. So when I combine the two of them, the low coherence with the high coherence, I can define a phase difference. So basically what I do is I measure the interferogram using a Hilbert transform. I determine what the phases are, and then I define this phase difference if the ratio of these two wavelengths have been set in such a way that one is 4/5 of the other one. And then basically what I can do is just look into the phase of the high coherence, of the coherent wave laser, and of course it's modulus 2 pi. These are just basically a sawtooth. But that is not the case for the low coherence. For the low coherence, this interferogram is defined only around two very distinct positions. So this difference is only defined only around two very distinct positions. Around those two positions, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the wavelength of the low coherence light by a little bit. So if these two were always in this fraction of 4/5, this difference will be exactly zero every time that both of them are well defined. Now, if I change the wavelength of one of them by a little bit, they are not going to be exactly the same and they are going to cross. And they are going to cross once when the optical path, this length is the same as the length up to the end of the fiber, and they are going to cross once again when this length is the same as that length. And those are the crossings. These are experimental data for the crossings. Two of them were too much to plot together. And those are the crossings happening when the position of this mirror, the optical length coincides with this, and when the optical length coincides with that one, this one and that one respectively. So this distance here is our delta x, the difference in the position of the mirror, which is equal to the difference, the distance between the end of the fiber and the substrate. Once I have that, I don't have to do the calibration again, because now I'm measuring always this separation and this angle. And from those two, I then can extract what z is. Okay? Those of you that are in optics know that there are a few things I have to worry about. I'm just going to mention the two that are the most important and why they are not so critical and why we are using a two-color interferometer. There is the curvature of field, and then there is the Gouy phase. Both of them are canceled by doing this two-color interferometer to a high degree. So basically we have a high precision in our two-color interferometer. Okay. Now we have to do the pressure determination, and there are three effects. When we do our measurement, we come to a new position, some separation, and then we oscillate the plate. So there are three effects. One is there is a new equilibrium position. The other one we discussed is a softer spring. And the third one, we have now a nonlinear oscillator. How do we know if we have a nonlinear oscillator? Well, what we do is we take a look into how well can we determine the frequency or the change in frequency as a function of the excitation of how much the plate is moving. The higher the amplitude of motion, the more nonlinear effects that we're going to be seeing. If the amplitude of motion is very small, basically what we see is that at the beginning there is no change in the resonant frequency as a function, on the determined resonant frequency, as a function of the amplitude of motion. And at some point, it basically takes off both two, it has two effects. One, the position of the resonant shifts. That is basically the same as saying in this nonlinear oscillator, our new, or the ball is going the new equilibrium position is no longer at zero. It's moving towards the nonlinear part. That is why this resonant frequency is changing, and it's becoming wider. That is because the resonant curve becomes hysteretic, as those of you have seen with when Hobun did his presentation. So what we do is we try to put our amplitude where the noise in the resonant frequency is the smallest possible. So there is a trade-off. If our amplitude is very small, then our noise becomes larger just because it is more difficult to measure the resonance curve. So we just try to find a point in which the noise is small, but still we don't see the contribution from the nonlinear effects. We also check that this resonance frequency is constant as a function of time. And you can see that we have an error on the order of a few millihertz in the resonance frequency. So from that, we can get the curves I showed you before. And that is basically is the end of the precision measurement of the for the Casimir force. What I'm going to be talking now is, this will be the end. What I will be talking next is about the comparison with the theory. What is the error budget that we have? So when we calculate these errors, experimental errors, we have two kinds of different errors. Some of them are random errors. We repeated the experiment 33 times, and the 33 times do not exactly give us the same contribution. So there are some random errors associated with that. There are also some systematic errors. There are systematic errors associated with the measurement of the resonant frequency. There is a systematic error associated with the measurement of the radius of the sphere. And there is a systematic error associated with the proximity force approximation. When we add in quadrature our random errors with our systematic errors, we get the full line that is shown in here. The dotted line are the systematic errors. The dashed line are the random errors. Important from an experimentalist point of view is that the systematic errors are always larger than the random errors. What this means is I can keep repeating my experiment over and over, and I'm not going to improve in my results. If I want to improve in my results, I have to first reduce the systematic errors, get a better way of measuring the resonant frequency, get a better way of measuring the radius, use something different instead of proximity force approximation, to name the three more important ones.
Remind us the diameter of the sphere.
For these specific measurements, it was 151.3 microns, 150 microns.
The diameter.
Oh, sorry, the radius, the diameter, 300 microns.
Also, I have a question. When you're running the experiment, you want to turn off the electrostatic interaction.
Correct.
So you actually have to put V.
I have to put V equals to that V out or V naught.
How crucial is the exact V in order to...
The exact value?
Yeah. And how much residual electrostatic interaction do you get compared with what you're interested in? Oh, that's a curve. You can say it now.
How crucial it is quadratic in the difference, so it is important to make it zero. There is here what is the theta in microradians as a function of B naught. So basically we can determine theta to 10 to the minus 9, which I showed that one biograph at the beginning. And the displacement that we are observing when we do the Casimir force are theta on the order of 10 to the minus 5. So the residual Casimir electrostatic contribution to the force is on the order of 10 to the minus 4, the contribution of the Casimir force. Okay? That's that answer. Yeah.
But for that, you really do need it to be stable. Absolutely.
B naught. Yeah. I need B naught to be stable, and it is stable to within about 0.1, 100 microvolts, 0.1 millivolt. As I show it in that it was not a function of position, not a function of time. And not a function also, not a function of separation, not a function of time, and not a function of position. That one I didn't show.
Now, in this PFA error, do you include the roughness?
No. The roughness we include it when we do the comparison with the theory, which is what we do here. Basically, So the answer to your question is no. In the PFA, which is a very
just sphere plate.
Right. It's a sphere against a plate, and we were just trying to see experimentally if we could come up with a number for the correction. And if I have time, I will discuss it. If not, I can discuss it with you. But in that case, we're just assuming it was a perfect sphere and a perfect plate. Roughness. So we have actual materials, so they are rough. And we have the plate, which is rough. And AFM picture of the plate is shown. Two of them are shown here on the right. These are basically a region of the plate before doing the experiment and after doing the experiment. Now, the fair question is, do I know if this is the region of the plate that was right under the sphere? And no, I have no clue. But I know that if I go through the whole plate doing AFMs, I recover the same thing irrespectively of where I do the AFM. Is that clear? So I'm not claiming that this is the position right under the sphere. What I am claiming is that there were no changes in the plate before and after doing the experiment. So there were no crashes or catastrophic problems in the experiment. This is a 10 by 10 microns. Each one of the grains or mounds is on the order of between 200 and 300 nanometers. And for the plate, I have a peak to valley. The maximum one that I have found is 20 nanometers. The RMS roughness is on the order of 5 nanometers for the plate. For the sphere, everything is a factor of 2 smaller. The deposition was better on the sphere, and so basically we have a peak to valley on the order of 10 nanometers and an RMS which is on the order of 3 nanometers. So the way how we incorporate in order to compare, I want to make something very clear here. The measurements already finished. Now I'm doing a comparison with a theory. So the precise measurements are already done. You might not like the theories now, but the measurements, the criticizing the measurements should come before what I'm going to say from now on.
Yeah. About the roughness, you are claiming accuracy, precision in your experiment without including the roughness, and then you are comparing.
Again, once again, I was up front when I was doing the drawing here. The only thing that you can say that it is incorrect, which I said before, is when I'm doing the electrostatic calibration, this is the electrostatic calibration between some surface and some other surface, and what I'm assuming is that those two surfaces are the same on the that for the Casimir force. If you do basically an argument of how large the difference, now what I'm looking is into the difference into those two positions, right? Those differences are on the order of 0.3 nanometers. I'm not saying, once again, I'm not saying that this is smooth to 0.3 nanometers. I'm saying that the position in which you can define the average surface differs in the electrostatic and the Casimir force to about 0.3 nanometers. If the next question is, where are they? I never measured that. I never came to contact. I always did the calibration from far away. So how this is incorporated into the theory is basically looking into what is the fraction of the area that are at a given separation, calculating the Casimir force, and then adding all those contributions. How is the finite conductivity and finite temperature taken into account using the Lipschitz formalism with reflection coefficients? In the reflection coefficients, the permittivity along the imaginary axis is taken into account using a Kramers-Kronig expansion. And, well, the parameters are all defining here, and you know those probably much better than myself. And then there is a summation over mass over frequencies. And one thing that is important is you can use a model in which, this is hard to see, and you have to see the laser pointer. So this is the calculation of epsilon along the imaginary axis for different materials, gold, aluminum, and copper, which are basically, gold and copper are these dashed lines, aluminum is the most different of them. And then there is a curve here, which is, if this is done, this is calculated using a plasma model. And then there is another curve, which is here, which coincides very well, agrees very well at low frequencies and has a little bit of a disagreement at higher frequencies, if what you use is a Drude model. And the actual aluminum, copper, and gold were obtained using experimental data for the imaginary part of epsilon.
For your sample?
No. The only one that I'm aware that has measured directly have done ellipsometry. So basically have gotten epsilon 1, epsilon 2 is Paransantas. So everybody else has not measured in their own samples. We have done something in between, which is to measure resistivity in our samples, which basically gives you an idea of what is the plasma frequency on the
Several people say that there is When you have errors in the optical parameters, plasma frequency and the other parameters, you could have a big error, 10% up to the Casimir force.
In the calculation of the Casimir force, correct. Well, not correct. I don't agree on the 10%, but I'm not the one doing the calculations. But right. If you have these parameters which are incorrect, then when you plug them back into the expression for the reflection coefficients, you're going to get a different expression for the Casimir force.
Yeah, that's just for the comparison between theory and experience.
Correct. I'm going to make a remark at the end.
You're saying that using that purely resonant form makes such a little difference.
Well, it makes a large difference, at low frequencies. But it doesn't make much difference in this range, which is where all the mass variable frequencies that are contributing to the expression for the Casimir force from 1 to about 400, but not the zero term. The zero term is a different one.
How far do you have to go up in the mass variable
frequency? At room temperature, they go up to about 300. 300
terms.
300 terms. Okay, so we do the comparison, introducing into the expression, if we use for the zeroth order Max-Bubara frequency, basically the Drude term, you get these dark gray curves. For the plasma frequency, you get the light curve, and the data are the dots. Just to give you a better idea, let me just put one of them. So we have the light gray, which are going basically there. We have the Drude, which are going there. And we have our experimental data, which are basically in there. So the agreement between our data and the plasma frequency is within the error bars are at the 95% confidence level. So within the 95% confidence level, we cannot say anything about the plasma frequency using an omega plasma of 9, or actually 8.9 electron volts. Using a Drude model, there is a disagreement. However, 9 electron volts, or 8.9 electron volts for gold, is the best gold, or close to the best gold that you're going to get. If you're going to say that we should be using a different one, what it's going to do is it's going to shift the plasma up. It's going to shift the Drude up. It's not going to improve the agreement with the Drude. Okay? Is the statement clear?
Just a question about the error bar. They are just the experimental one. The error bar are just the experimental accuracy.
Right. The theoretical error is the width of this band, also 95%.
In the same case in the plasma,
Yeah, but it's kind of hard to see. It also has a band which is about the same width. Yes.
And the roughness correction is in the theoretical model, it's not in the experimental.
Correct. The roughness and the uncertainty on the parameters to be used is in the calculation and not in the measurement. I never use them in the measurement.
Which roughness model do you use? Just averaging the sample.
Just the average enough. Yes, we did verify that there were no patterns that will give enhanced contribution just by matching surfaces and that kind of stuff. But the one that we at the end we use is just average of the separations over the surfaces.
Okay.
when you look to see what might be adhering to those surfaces in the course of manipulation, how do you check that?
We have not done it. Basically, what we do is we deposit our sample in vacuum, and we measure without moving it. Sometimes, and we do not know what happens, is
it's in the vacuum from the time we make
the sample until we finish our measurement.
And the vacuum is
10^-6. Yes.
One more question for the disorder.
And it is oil free, but it is 10^-6.
One more question for the disorder. There's a big difference between ensemble averaging and a single realization.
Say that again.
There's a big difference between looking at the average motion or distortion of a curve due to the rough surface and what you get if you do one experiment where you have a single realization of the disorder. Is there any subtlety there? You do an experiment, you have one realization, and then you could imagine averaging over.
No, we don't have one realization, but we do have we do repeat the experiment. The Casimir force experiment was repeated 33 times,
sure.
And the electrostatic calibration is repeated 1,300 or some times because it's done only one. I don't know if I have done enough partitioning of the data set in order to answer your question. In order to say, can I group them in different ways that such that will give me some results that are outside the average? I honestly don't know.
Just another small question about the error bar. The error bar is the absolute error. Or you are measuring what's the absolute error is the relative error. What's
the absolute error? It is there is an error bar which is at a 95% confidence level. So basically 2 sigma, if you wish. It's not exactly, but it's close. And there is an error on the horizontal axis too.
Okay, because it's almost constant. Null.
In this range are right, but. It is not constant. It's what I show. I mean, when I subtract it and I show it, it wasn't constant. So. Okay. The only characterization that we have for our sample, as I said before, is we do not have. Somebody asked. We do not have a measurement of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. The only measurement that we have is resistivity as a function of temperature from the slope. You could get an idea of the plasma frequency, and we get 8.9. If your question is, will it be better to have the ellipsometric measurements, the answer is by all means, and we are trying to do it. But for these experiments, we didn't have them. Okay. I am at the end of the first topic. It is up to you if you want to listen. Can I use 5 minutes just to summarize the low temperatures?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. What happens? Okay, there is this discrepancy. Whichever way you look at it, there is this difference between the Drude and the plasma model. And we were expecting, if we now do a measurement at low temperatures, in which the relaxation time that we have to put in the Drude is going to be decreasing because the electron-phonon interaction is going to be decreasing, so the metal will become a better metal, and the Drude should become closer to the plasma, and then we have to do the measurement at low temperatures and try to see if, on the same sample, then even if I don't do the measurements of the epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, it still is the same sample. It has the same roughness. So basically what we're trying to do is just try to keep the sample constant, do two different measurements at two different temperatures in which we were expecting to see a difference in the Casimir force. Make a long story short, I can then talk about the experimental details. there are changes in the resonant frequencies of the system by itself, just as we cool it down, and that is just because we are making the material stiffer. So the oscillator by itself, the resonant frequency increases as we go down in temperatures. The measurements were done at three fixed temperatures, one at 77 Kelvin or liquid nitrogen, liquid helium, or pump liquid helium in our system. Due to instabilities in the system, two kinds of stabilities. One is coming from bubbling, so the system is shaking much more in our low temperatures measurements than in our high temperature or room temperature measurements. And the other problem that we found out and we really never expected, the optical fiber that we had in order to do the to do the interferometer, there is a branch of this optical fiber which is going into the liquid into the cryostat. The level of cryogenic liquids is changing as we do the experiments. Our experiments take in total something like on the order of 12 hours to do. So we have to refill with nitrogen when we're doing the experiment. But at any rate, the temperature on the fiber is not constant. Since the temperature in the fiber is not constant, the index of refraction in the fiber is not constant. And we have one optical path which is changing, the one that goes into the sample, and the other one which is not. So then we do start getting this drift, and this drift becomes on the order of 5 nanometers, which so far we have not been able to compensate for.
You are still using gold.
Gold. It was gold in at room temperature.
Just everything in cryostat.
Correct. So we did the experiment. The blue curve is our 300 measurements. Green, red, and blue, or black, sorry, are the measurements at the three other different temperatures, and they are about at the same position, except that when you do the difference, if I were to plot this on the same graph, subtracting the red curve from the blue curve from all the other one, the error that we got, that we get in the low temperature measurement, is on the order of 5 millipascal at 400 nanometers, which is much larger than the difference, for example, between the Drude and the plasma, which is on the order of 2.5 millipascal. So we went through all this work and we came up empty-handed because we couldn't address the question we were trying to address. So we are still working on this system, but it's really requiring a lot of work to get all these systematics under control in order to be able to reduce the noise.
So, yeah. What would happen if you heat it and then cool it?
It's even worse. The problems are, some of them are the same. I mean, for example, the variation of temperature in the fiber is going to be there either you heat it or you cool it, and actually it's worse if you heat it. Then if you heat it 50 degrees or if you cool it 50 degrees, thermal expansions are more if you heat it, right? At some point, thermal expansion, which is also associated with the anharmonic potential in phonons, at some point it just cools off or disappears or plateaus. If you keep heating, it just keeps becoming larger and larger. So it is much more difficult to do the measurement at constant temperature when you go up in temperature. If you go down, then you have liquid gas interfaces that you can use as a fixed temperature. When you start going up, you just have to control the temperature. So it's actually more complicated to do it at high temperatures than at low temperatures, although at low temperatures we have not been able to do it. Let me go to the summary. I bypassed the proximity force approximation part. But basically what...
Should we be worried? Or?
No. for these spheres, no. So basically, I show precise measurements of the Casimir force, and at the position that we are basically now trying to find out if we can reduce the systematic errors to try to improve even further the determination of the Casimir pressure. We observe a good agreement with the plasma model, not a good agreement or not agreement whatsoever with the Drude model. Every correction that you can think that from the theoretical part, for example, the ones that were brought up on the determination of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, will make the disagreement even worse. There is another thing that you could say, well, there is this shift in the position that it might be wrong. If you shift these curves all parallel by 1 nanometer, it doesn't improve the agreement substantially with the Drude, expression. And as I said very many times, everybody's welcome to get my data and do all these, play with all these shifts as you wish.
But it looked like if you were to shift them by 9 nanometer.
If you were to shift it by a large amount, it will fit right at, for example, you can have one shift and then it will be right at small separations. A different shift and then it will be right at higher separations. But not a single shift. And as I said, I mean, don't take my word for it. Just try to do it with the data. You cannot get a single shift that is going to make it coincide with everything. In other words, if you try to use the Drude to calibrate my data, it doesn't work. Is that clear what I'm trying to say?
Okay.
And finally, we did get some preliminary data on the temperature dependence, although did not solve the problem we were trying to address. And with that, if you have questions about, of course, the part I presented or even the proximity force, I would be glad to discuss them with you. Thanks.
So there are now predictions for the first corrections to the proximity force approximation based on electromagnetic calculations. Do you have
the measurements that we did? Basically, what we did is we expanded the force in first order on Z over R with some coefficient that different predictions will tell us what these coefficients are,
right.
Some negative, some positive, and. And you can do the same for the pressure, and it will be a different coefficient. If this were to be in this expression that I'm using, if this were to be the same an ideal metal, then beta prime will be 2/3 of beta. So what we do then is at each position, we basically at each separation we just use Z over R. So we basically plot the normalized force, the force divided by 2 pi r epsilon, and plot that at each separation as a function of Z over R. And then the slope is going to be beta. And we repeat that at all the different separations. That's what I said. This is an experimentalist way of looking into this order, right? And we do that for both the pressure and the force. Incidentally, here is the... what I was saying before, that the relative error becomes much larger at higher separations.
What do you mean by, because maybe I misunderstood you, you're saying that for beta there are various predictions even this different sign, was it, or I misunderstood?
There is a prediction in which the correction should be negative.
But minus. You can compute beta basically exactly for the electromagnetic problem of the C-under plane, so I don't know what you...
Say that again? For the two polarizations?
Exactly. Yes. No, even for the electric.
And what value did you get?
Well, I mean, I can tell you for perfect conducting, and then if you
right.
want to do it for the electric, for perfect, it's around 0.4.
Say that again?
0.4.
0.4, right. We get that this beta prime at 300 nanometers is... consistent with or less than on the order of 0.4. This is for beta prime. This is on the pressure. So actually, if you want to do it in here, that is a problem. This the measurement with the force is not, and this is the one you're talking about, right, on beta. And the measurement on the force is not as precise as the measurement, and it is, we get a zero, but well, basically you get a zero with anything. All of the betas I have seen are actually within our error bars.
Okay, but I mean, the 0.4 is for perfect matters.
Right.
One had to do the computation.
For a dielectric and find out what it is, or better yet for us, for if you can do the same for this for the gradient of the force, then it's easier to compare with our data because we have a much better values for this beta prime.